Welcome to Goodfellow Podcasts. This episode is kindly supported by the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners, the Auckland faculty. I'm Dr. Louise Kugler, and today I welcome to the podcast Dr. Gary Clearwater. Gary is the Chief Clinical Advisor for the Coronial Services at the Ministry of Justice. He also works as a part-time emergency medicine specialist. Gary has worked for more than 20 years as a medical referee for cremations, and he has a special interest in death certification. Kia ora, Gary, and welcome to the podcast.
Kia ora, Louise, thanks very much for the opportunity to join you.
So today we're discussing death certification for those older than 28 days, and the Burial and Cremation Act 1964 is the legislation that we should all be aware of. I wonder if you could tell us about this act, please.
The Act is one of the few times where we as health practitioners are filling in forms covered very specifically by legislation. And the important context is that when a patient dies, society retains an interest. I mean, we as health practitioners should as well, but you know, society has a strong interest in what follows on from a death. It has an interest in determining that a person is dead and sort of keeping a record of that, figuring out what they died of and making a record of that, and getting on with the grieving process for the whānau and, in crude forms, disposal of the body. So that's an important context because the natural reflex of doctors once a patient dies is, well, look, I've got these living patients who I still have to deal with and prioritize, and the, you know, one dead patient is one less patient that I can do anything more for. So the Burial and Cremation Act is society or Parliament's way of drawing practitioners' attention to the need to deal to these other issues, recognizing that otherwise practitioners would just leave certification of death and all the subsequent arrangements to the end of the day or the end of the week or the end of the financial year. So the Burial and Cremation Act, particularly relevant section of section 46C, really outlines under what conditions a death certificate can be filled in, who can complete the certificate. And it's a surprise to many doctors that it specifies that there is an ideal practitioner who should fill in the certificate, but also reluctantly, if that practitioner is not available, then there are strict conditions under which another practitioner can fill the certificate in instead. Also includes an exemption for notifying the coroner, because while the Burial and Cremation Act doesn't outline the criteria for referral to the coroner, it does outline an important exemption, which is death in elderly patients who die as a result of an injury. And these are patients who also have significant medical problems. But anyway, the key thing is it is an important bit of legislation. And actually, every time a practitioner signs a cremation certificate, they are actually acknowledging that they're aware specifically of the Burial and Cremation Act. So if you read the fine print of what you're signing, it says you're a registered health practitioner entitled under Section 46B and Section 46C of the Burial and Cremation Act to write the cremation certificate. Now, I do know from experience that most doctors don't actually know what Section 46B and Section 46C are, but the regulators assume you do. The medical council assumes you do, and there's no defence to say you're not aware of that. So it's important to know that the Act is there, and particularly what Section 46B and Section 46C are.
Thank you. So the Medical Certificate of Cause of Death, the form is HP 4720, is the form that we're going to complete when somebody has died and they're over the age of 28 days. So you mentioned there are specific people who can complete this form. Can you tell us who those people are, please?
Yes. The regulators figured out correctly that the best person to fill in a death certificate would be someone who knew the patient before they died, to the degree that they would recognise the patient. In other words, they'd know who this person is who's died, and they would have a fair idea of whether this death was expected or unexpected or explicable, and would also be able to sort of give some sort of assurance that there was no further investigation required. So section 46B essentially says the person who should complete the certificate is the a doctor who or nurse practitioner who attended the deceased in their last illness. Now, just as a sort of side issue, the definition of attended and the definition of the last illness is not otherwise clarified. But the principle is, in fact, the specifics of the Burial and Cremation Act is that the attending doctor should do the certificate. And anyone else has to fulfill other certain criteria before they could do that.
Right. Okay. So thinking about completing the form then, what must happen? So firstly, we have to verify that the person is dead.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, this is such an important point, I think, to remember. While doctors are pretty comfortable with the fact that someone's died, you know, allowing for the fact that it's sort of horrible and distressing for whānau, et cetera, but, you know, society, in the sense of non-health practitioners, have a whole lot of concerns about what's going to happen when they die. And one of them is if they're going to be put in a coffin and buried in the ground, or they're going to be put in a cremator, they want to be sure that they're absolutely confirmed to be dead. While we would think, well, that's pretty straightforward, you know, historically that wasn't always so straightforward. So, you do need to have a system to verify death. In fact, the Te Whatu Ora has actually got a specific guideline on criteria for verifying death. Remembering, when you're filling in the death certificate, you're not actually specifying that you've confirmed the person's dead. It's assumed that's been verified, but other people can verify the death as such, in the sense that paramedics, nurses, morticians are all entitled to declare that a person is dead. But and so that's a sort of given up to the point when you are now issuing the death certificate. It's more about confirming the identity and the cause of the death.
Okay, so that's been done. And what about confirming identity? Do we have to do anything special? I'm assuming generally best practice is that we know this person, but is there anything special we need to do here?
Yeah, no, well, again, this gets back to the ideal person to fill the certificate is the one who knew the patient before they died. So easiest if you recognise the patient, someone you'd known while they were alive, you were familiar with. Occasionally, it might be someone you very rarely attended, in which case you'll need to identify them via ancillary methods. For example, there'll be a nurse if it's a patient who died on the ward, or hopefully a member of the whānau who will identify the person to you. Occasionally, it comes down to needing, you know, a passport or a driver's license or some other documentation to do that. It's often a combination of one or more of those. But remember, if we know that 70 to 80% of deaths will be cremated, it's particularly important to be sure that you have identified the right person, because if a cremation proceeds, you can't go back later and double check. There's nothing to double check.
So then the last thing we need to make a decision about before we complete the form is whether or not we should be reporting to the coroner, or if we can go ahead and fill in this form. So what would help us decide on this?
I think the most important thing is don't forget that it might need to go to the coroner. There is a little prompt on the death certificate. Either you think it has been discussed with the coroner or doesn't need to be discussed with the coroner. But the criteria, again, as an example, the regulators just assume that practitioners will know these criteria, or they'll know where to access those criteria. I don't think it's reasonable to remember all of the criteria, but the surprising ones are anyone who's died an unnatural death. So anyone who's died as a result of an injury, sort of either directly or maybe some sort of delayed complications of an injury, by default should go to the coroner. That also, and unnatural deaths also include overdoses, self-harm, any sort of external force. The second is a group of people who, like women who die in childbirth or as a result of pregnancy, which is a bit of a surprise to people. And the commonest sort of troublesome trap is that any patient who was in some sort of protective custody at the time they died, automatically has to be referred to and taken on by the coroner. So, for example, someone who's committed under the Mental Health Act, or someone who's in police custody, or who's in a prison, or detained by a security officer. There are a number of other sort of subsets as well, but that's a protective mechanism built in for other reasons, which is essentially that if you, as a member of the public, are detained against your will in custody, and then if you die, there will be an independent review held to check that everything was done appropriately, and the independent reviewer will be the coroner. My main point is, be aware of the traps and know where to check the detail when you're considering filling in a certificate. The online death documents now runs through an option, sort of like a sieve of the various criteria that you might not have thought about. Otherwise, you can find it online fairly easily, just New Zealand criteria for referral to the coroner. Remember, it's much better to be aware of that and make that decision early, because if you miss it and the body's embalmed, that makes the utility of a post-mortem very much less useful. So coroners are very reliant on practitioners either knowing the criteria or knowing where to find the criteria.
Fantastic. The other question I have in this time that we're in is viewing the body. So do we have to view the body personally to be able to complete the form, or can this be done remotely, perhaps by telehealth? What's the criteria here, please?
Yeah, it's a good question. And you know, look, it's an issue that's an evolution. The default is, if you knew the patient before they died and then they die, you don't have to view the body after death. If you're confident that it was an expected death, you can issue a certificate without viewing or examining the body at all, so long as it's a burial. Keeping in mind also that 70 to 80% of deaths will be cremated, and keeping in mind that the regulators are very nervous and somewhat have a negative attitude to cremation, because, you know, remember, cremation in legal terms is burning the evidence. So there's a whole lot of extra criteria for cremation, one of which is that you have to examine the body after death. Now, that can't be done via video or sort of phone viewing, because part of the requirement for a cremation is you have to literally examine the body for the presence of a biomechanical aid, which is to say a battery-powered device, and you can't tell that by phone or video. Now, a lot of people think, well, look, I know the patient well enough that I'm confident they don't have one, but that's not the point. As a medical referee, I think I've collected about 25 or 30 cases where doctors have certified there's no pacemaker when in fact there was one. So you may be overconfident about your ability to detect it, but the bald fact is the regulations state that you have to examine the body after death for a cremation, and the corollary to that is it can't be done by a smartphone. However, if you have a patient that you know who's died in a rest home or a private hospital, there is now a temporary exemption which says you don't have to examine the body after death. Instead, there's a separate process using the special legal exemption, just like introduced, I think, at the beginning of the year, which if you're going to invoke that exemption, then the funeral director has to arrange a separate declaration of the identity of the deceased, and their embalmer has to examine the body and issue a certificate that there's no biomechanical aid. But certainly, in all other criteria, you would have to examine the body physically after death.
Thank you. And what is the time frame for completing the form?
Yeah, so this is a surprise to many people. The wording in the Burial and Cremation Act is that a practitioner must issue the certificate, quote, immediately, unquote, after they are informed of the death. That is, you've got to issue it straight away. Now, in practical terms, you're not going to drop everything and do that. But what it's trying to convey is you have to make that decision very, very quickly. And the reason for that is, A, it might be a coroner's case that needs to be decided early, and B, the family want to just crack on with making their arrangements and knowing what to expect. So you have to really make a decision fairly clearly and very early about the need, and the measure is, in legal terms, immediately. That's the default.
Can I just give an example of that and find out what is okay? So if you were to get a phone call on a Sunday afternoon, it's your day off, the patient's died in hospital, perhaps. What's our responsibility as a primary care doctor there?
Yeah, so if it's in a public hospital, you can pretty much count on the hospital staff issuing that certificate. That would be the expectation. Outside of hospital, then it's going to usually fall to a GP or to a nurse practitioner to do that. Remember, I think the important thing is to make the decision quickly. It doesn't necessarily mean you've got to actually issue it straight away, though technically it does. As I say, the important point is that the funeral director and the family need to know what's going to happen to the body, and that's what they're relying on the doctor to make that key decision. So in one scenario, the practitioner will say, well, I'm totally surprised by that death. It's unexpected. There's nothing there in the background history to explain the death. That would be quite a different set of outcomes compared to you saying, oh, yes, this is an expected death. There were lots of medical conditions, any of which could have explained the death. It's essentially an expected death. You know, you can see that there'd be quite a big difference as to what's going to happen to the body, depending on where that death lies on the spectrum.
Okay, great. Thank you for clarifying that. So let's talk more about the form. So part one is causes of death. So I wonder if we can just start with a definition, perhaps as per the World Health Organization. What is the cause of death?
And look, this is a source of continual confusion. So if you're a practitioner who's not sure how to fill it, welcome to the club. It's everyone's sort of puzzles over this to some degree. The key thing to remember is to identify the underlying cause of death, the condition that might have started a sequence of other conditions that led up to the death. But the death certificate is going to be used by Te Whatu Ora for generating epidemiological data. It's going to be looked at by the family, maybe including should there be something that they should be thinking about getting tested for. So in practical terms, if you can identify the underlying cause or likely cause of death, then that's separate from the intervening causes of death, which is why you have up to three different parts in sequence to the death. So think about it as the term used by the World Health Organization is the disease which initiated the train of morbid events leading directly to the death. So that might be ischemic heart disease, or it might be cancer, or it might be, you know, type 2 diabetes, which lead to a whole lot of complications. But you can cut it a number of ways, and you don't have to focus, you don't have to be too concerned about capturing everything, so long as you just capture the ones that you think are reasonably the most important ones.
So let's hone in on that a little bit. So there are three sections that need to be completed. Section A is the direct cause of death.
So you don't have to fill in all three sections. Actually, I should say the ministry's got quite a good guideline online now about filling in death certificates. It's actually quite user-friendly. It's easy to find online. If you just look under, you know, either Te Whatu Ora causes of death or just causes of death New Zealand. So that they allow a sequence of up to three conditions, but you could quite often just fill it in with one or possibly two. The three options are there because sometimes there is a cascade of things. But what's probably less important than the direct cause of death is the underlying cause of death, which could be 1A. If we use an example, say someone has a pulmonary embolus due to metastatic cancer, it doesn't matter too much about the pulmonary embolus compared to the underlying cancer. So you could reasonably omit or include the pulmonary embolus as 1A, so long as the antecedent or underlying cause is listed. That's what the epidemiologists and Te Whatu Ora are most interested in.
Fantastic. Okay. Then we're asked about the interval between the onset and death. And this can sometimes be a bit tricky because the onsets are presumed. So what guidance can you give us here?
Yeah, look, I think quite rightly, it's recognised we don't know a lot about the onset. So someone who presents to us with cancer, for example, who knows how long ago that started before it's subclinical. So you're allowed to just list it in very general terms as best as you can without specifying a number. So it might be a condition, say, for minutes if it was a VF cardiac arrest, or it could be cancer for years. You know, you don't have to specify the number of years or the number of minutes. So you just either say it was minutes or hours or days or weeks or months or years as best you can. but you know, you're not expected to know exactly what the duration is.
Excellent. Okay. So then we move on to part two, which is also cause of death. How do we fill this part in?
I'd have to say this is the most overlooked and underutilized part of the death certificate. My suggestion is think of part two as the factors, if there are any, that constitute a ceiling of therapy or the reasons for a ceiling of therapy. So, for example, you could have 1A pneumonia, and I guess technically you could leave it at that. But if that patient had pneumonia and didn't go to intensive care or wasn't admitted from their rest home to an acute hospital, part two would be where you would list the reasons for that. So, for example, the patient may have advanced dementia, or they may have, you know, severe disabilities of some other sort that make you as the certifying practitioner aware that it wouldn't have been appropriate or reasonable to send them to an acute hospital or to take them to theatre. So say that 1A was a perforated bowel, 1B might have been diverticular disease, but if part two might be severe COPD or severe heart failure, for example. So part two explains why there is a ceiling of therapy. So just use that section to sort of help clarify to someone who's not otherwise going to know much about the patient if they're looking at it years later to know, okay, I can see why that person didn't get taken to theatre or didn't go to ICU, for example, or didn't get admitted to an acute hospital.
So then we're asked to fill in about infectious diseases. So why is it important to fill this part in correctly, and what conditions do we need to consider here and why?
Yeah, good question also, and doctors often get this mixed up. So what that is like a little message to the funeral director as to what precautions they have to take in handling the body. And unfortunately, a lot of certifying practitioners mistake that to mean, is there an infection? So the specific subsection refers to notifiable infectious diseases, the sort of conditions where the funeral director might have to tell a whānau, look, you can't embrace the body, you can't get too close to it, you can't kiss or otherwise touch the body closely because there's a risk of a transmissible disease. The list is on Te Whatu'ora's list of communicable diseases or notifiable infectious diseases. That's what it's for. So, for example, again, if someone died of pneumonia, pneumonia doesn't have to go on there, but say it was tuberculosis, then it would have to go on there.
So, place of death, how much information do we need to include here?
Yeah, the only interest is whether they died in their own residence or they died somewhere else. And if they died and if their own residence was possibly a rest home or a private hospital, you might need to specify otherwise. It's not really a particularly useful bit of information. And that's one of the problems with the certificate. I counted up when people were filling in handwritten death and cremation certificates, we were having to fill in or answer 51 separate bits of information. And some of them are really important and some of them are less important. The place of death is, just a sort of a small extra bit of information, but I wouldn't fuss too much about what you put on there.
Okay. So at this point, if we're unsure about the cause of death or anything to do with death certification, who do we call for help?
Yes, indeed. The easiest is to have some online resource that you can access. And so a key point is most of us are not doing death certificates frequently enough that we become really familiar with it. The best death certificates by far are issued as a group by hospices, as you would expect. They deal with it all the time. They're familiar with it. They do it often enough. And they have a sort of a good organisational sort of knowledge of how this works. But most of us aren't doing them often enough. So you should just know where to go. And one option is Auckland Regional Health Pathways. They have a good, if you've got a login for that, they have a good section on all the criteria and the various steps involved in death certification. You could, if you're really unsure, ring your local medical referee. So I've been working as a medical referee for a long time and people do ring me for advice and I'm happy to give it because it's much easier to give that beforehand. Or a lot of useful information is now being collated by Te Whatu'ora on their website about how to fill in a certificate and some of those issues. death documents online, which I'd strongly recommend people get a login and use routinely, helps guide you through a lot of those. Electronically, it sort of has hints as you progress through the documentation. Or finally, if you're really stuck, I have a Crudel website where you can access that information. It's not a very slick website, but it's called www.cremation.org.nz. And I would hope that most of the sort of finer, more specific questions you could find an answer to there. But the key point is you can't reasonably be expected to memorize everything there is to know about death certification, but you should at least know where to go or have some go-to option when the day arises that you do have to fill one in.
Okay, so let's move on to cremation now. If cremation is requested, what are our obligations here?
The key thing to remember is just the principle. The regulators have set up a whole lot of extra steps to go through because they don't like the idea of you burning the evidence. Keep that in mind, right? The whole process is about, they've just thought of a whole lot of questions that they're going to ask, because better to ask them now because they won't get those answers after the body's cremated. So that's the background to the separate so-called Form B, which is the medical certificate for cremation. So it's just getting those details clearly documented before the body's irretrievably burned. Key thing is go through them step by step, because this is another unusual form for us as medical practitioners, where it's one of the few forms where an independent doctor is going to review that certificate and check all the required details are there and that they comply with the legal requirements, which is in itself an illustration of the importance that the regulators have put on the fact that cremation is irreversible and they want everything met before they agree the body can be cremated. But in practical terms, you have to examine the body after death, as we discussed, unless it's a patient known to you who died in a rest home and private hospital, in which case make sure the funeral director knows so that they can generate those extra forms. But then otherwise, it's just tediously going through the steps, which is, you know, a bit more information about what's your relationship to the person. Did you actually examine them? How did you confirm they were dead? You know, none of these questions are asked on the death certificate because it's sort of assumed, but they're just being a much more specific because of the upcoming cremation.
And do we have to be able to access the patient's medical notes in order to complete the form?
Yes, and that technically applies for, yes and no. Actually, it's a good question, Louise. The Burial and Cremation Act says that if you're a practitioner and you attended the person in the last illness and you know that after you saw them, someone else subsequently saw them, you should make some reasonable inquiries about what they found, just in case it wasn't going to match up with your expectations as to the cause of death. That's a sort of sensible precaution. And the best way to do that is to check the medical record. So if you were the last practitioner to see the person, and assuming that you'd had a chance to read the records at that stage when you saw the person alive, then you probably don't have to worry too much about checking the records. But in any other scenario, it would probably be worthwhile just double checking that there's nothing in the medical records subsequent to your assessment that might affect your willingness or what you're going to write on the death certificate or cremation certificate. Short answer is yes, if you've got them, you should probably have a look at them.
Fantastic. The other question that's just come to mind is, if somebody dies in the community in their own home, can they be moved to the funeral home before you have completed either the forms?
Very good question again. At one extreme, it'll be a patient that you knew was going to die and had someone there with them. In other words, it's an expected death. You know, the body can be moved because you're basically confident there's nothing suspicious about the death. But at the other extreme, you know, there's that group of people who live on their own or their partner or family member is away and they're found dead at home. And in those situations, usually the police will be informed before the doctor, but I guess it's possible that a family member might find the person dead and then ring the doctor. But generally, the police will need to be notified. And the reason for that is if it's an unwitnessed death, particularly if it's not entirely expected, the police will probably want to have a scene examination and just check things out a little bit before you go in and sign the death certificate. Remembering, you're not expected to be a forensic scientist. It's helpful if you knew this was an expected death, but even people who have critical illness or chronic illness can still be assaulted or could still take their own lives. So the police will usually want to check that out before the body's disturbed. Those are two extremes, and you just have to make a decision. And sometimes the decision's made for you. Typically, some family member or caregiver tries to contact someone who lives on their own, but there's no answer to the phone or the doorbell. Then either they break in or they call the police and the police break in. Then often an ambulance is called if there's any possibility the person's alive. And that's all going to be done anyway. But be aware, basically just be aware, just because a person's dead doesn't mean to say you can assume it's an entirely natural death. There's always that faint suspicion for someone who's died in the community that there might have been something untoward. Just keep that in mind.
Great. Are there any other specific situations that we should be thinking of when completing either a death certificate or a cremation certificate? Is there anything we haven't covered today that we should consider?
Yep. My other point is, what is a biomechanical aid? A good example of badly worded legislation. The legislators knew what they meant when they define a biomechanical aid as a battery-powered device, but we as clinicians have a completely different idea of the definition of a biomechanical aid. So the question about biomechanical aid is really about, is there anything on the body that's got stored energy that could explode in the heat of a cremator? So that can include, you know, an internal defibrillator or a nerve stimulator or most commonly a pacemaker, but that's all they want to know. Now, please don't write, yes, there is total hip joint replacement, without answering the key question. All the crematorium's interested in is there or is there not? They need a specific answer one way or the other, a battery-powered device that could explode in our cremator. So you can say there's a hip joint prosthesis, they don't care, but if you do, don't forget to add, and no battery-powered device. That's a common cause of angst and delay. Otherwise, just be careful about answering all the questions. There's no easy way to do that, though I would again emphasize, get a login for death documents. That saves you rewriting a whole lot of information that's carried through from one part of the certificate into another part. It saves you sort of literally having to write it out twice. And it now has increasing guidance built in to take you through the steps of completing it correctly.
That's a fantastic tip. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today, Gary. I wonder if we can just conclude with some take-home messages for our listeners, please.
Yeah, I think the take-home messages is it still matters after the person's dead. There's still people with a big stake or interest in what happens after the death. And that role, the doctors are still heavily involved in that step. So don't just forget about it when a patient dies. Remember, there are a whole lot of other stakeholders who have a very strong interest in it. And they're going to be very attentive to what you're doing and to the need to make a timely decision. The second one is just be aware that there are traps. You don't have to know what all the traps are. But my third point is, the one thing you should know really is, where will you go to find that information when the day comes you need to fill in the certificate? Have something sorted out beforehand so that you can check the details if you're not sure, because every death is different. And the circumstance is always different. There's often an odd question. So that plan of where will I go or who will I ask is the most important thing to have ready for the day when it comes to certifying the death.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Gary, for your time today. You'll find a list of resources that Gary's mentioned on our website, including his website at goodfellowunit.org. Thank you for listening.
Okay. Thanks, Louise. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. Thanks.